and happy, thankful If we haven't had the pleasure of meeting before, my name is Roy Garcia, and father of two daughters, grandfather for three under the age of four. I'm not sure what they were thinking, but married for 33 years. My wife is a fourth grade teacher in the district, has been doing that about 22 years. So, you know, I always talk about feedback for breakfast of champions, and we all want to be champions. And trust me, I get a lot of feedback here every night at home, you know, from speeding and everything that's been going on. But just glad you're here. Appreciate you investing your time and giving your time to be here. We want to start. Check members, you got a little window card, and if someone came in and I didn't get that to you, let me know. The rest of you, you've got one at the table. So one beside, who wants to look at that? I don't know if you've seen these before, but on the back you have a little note, I'll just call it. And then turn it back over, and then on the right-hand side you'll see a little perforated edge where you open it up, and it has some type of quote inside. We'll give you all a minute to do that and read that quote. And again, if you've got the table card, just share with those at the table what it says. And share with your neighbors. Yes. What does yours say? Alright, you know this already, but this just serves as a little reminder for us, the power of words. And even more specifically, the words to encourage others to lift people up. I don't know what your card said, but you do, and as I share sometimes, if you don't like exactly what yours said, then change with your neighbor, you know. But it is just a reminder of that. And then on the back, obviously, you've got just a little quick message. You know, hopefully it's something that you needed to hear today. There's a lot going on. There always is a lot going on, but just what I try to do is, I started with that. Just think back to my loved ones. You know, think back to those grandkids. As soon as I think about those three grandkids, and they're coming to see me on Saturday and will be with us for 2 weeks, it just gives me that energy, that fuel. And I know some of you are thinking, man, you're going to be tired. I will, but it's okay. They're worth it. You know, they keep us young. And whatever it is for you. And also understanding that sometimes the holidays, there are challenges as well, because we've lost loved ones and we've had other situations that maybe aren't always positive memories. And I can't, there's no way in the world I can walk in your shoes, but I just try to encourage you to find the good, to look at what you can celebrate as a blessing, and then just know we're excited and we're fortunate that on January 1, we get to kind of have a restart. In education, we love that. Why? Because we get two restarts, one in August and then one in January. And then just quickly, if you haven't heard of The One Word by John Gordon, I would encourage you to kind of to research that. And what he asked us to do, rather than doing a, what do you call that at the beginning of the year when you say you're going to, ooh, I'm going to work out every day, or what is that called? Yeah, and you know what the data is on that? 85%. They're not successful with that. So what John says is, rather than doing that, or in addition to doing that, pick one word that's going to lead you all 365 days. And don't just, maybe you can, but what he encouraged you to do, to really process and think about that. Perhaps even pray about, what is that one word that's going to be your inspiration throughout all 365 days? And I don't mind sharing with you, my word last January was peace. And it's just thinking about, okay, well, I don't want you to tell you all that. Just what can we do in the role that I'm in personally and professionally to always just to have that peace about whatever's happening and to know that things are going to work out. It's not necessary for me to get so uptight and stressed and all of that. Now, I don't bat a thousand on that, but I do come back to, you know, what is that word? So something just for you to think about. We are going to move forward, and you can see on the screen And you got a copy of the agenda, but just quickly you can look and see what's in store today. We're excited because we do get we've got a couple of speakers, and everybody in this room knows somebody, unfortunately, that has either had the flu, RSV, COVID-19, where we are, and many other illnesses out there. There's a lot going on. There's a lot going around. There's a lot that has happened in our schools. And it's just one of those situations where I think it's beneficial for us to kind of be educated about what we can do and what the data looks like. And then you'll see we have another Katie, Saving Lives Today and Educating Heroes of the Future from Gulf Coast Regional Blood Center. It's always, blood is always needed, but as you know, even more so during the holidays. So just if you're able and you're willing, or you know someone that is, it's always something that I've been giving blood for, gosh, probably 30 years now. And it's just something that I like to do. Now, I will tell you, when you walk in, they're going to, I'm going to give whole blood, and they're going to want the red blood cells, and they're going to want the platelets, but you do what you're comfortable with if you do make that step there. So with that, just quickly, a reminder, in case you weren't here last time, just every meeting, even as a classroom teacher, back in when I started in 1989, we had community agreements. We had social contracts as a class. You know, as a member of this class, how do you want to be treated? You know, and that's the same concept in any organization, if it's a classroom, if it's, you know, family discussions, whatever. You set those norms. And you can just see on the screen what we established. Attend all meetings and participate meaningfully in the council's work. I'm not going to read the rest to you, but you can just kind of see. And that last one's a good reminder to me to make sure my phone is on silence. And I think it's always a good practice too. We have established these, but it's also nice to talk about, is there any others that we need to add? Because this is something that we can always make modifications to. Is there something that you see as you read those, like, gosh, I wish such and such was there? Let us know what that is. I mean, just, you can raise your hand and you can tell us. Or you can leave us a little note for next time, whatever you want to do in that respect. Anyone? Okay, if something else comes up, we can definitely do so. And just quickly again, I know you've seen this before. How many of you have served on the shack previous to this year? Raise your hand. Okay, you know this very well, but just a reminder for all of us kind of what the purpose is of shack. And then with that, I'm going to turn it over to Melinda so she can introduce our speaker, and I'll go back to the agenda so you can see that, and then I know that Carolyn and Arlene will have their own PowerPoint. Any questions as we transition a little bit? Anything I can do for you? You know this already, but you'll have lunch when Chef comes in. I told him just to interrupt us, so he loves kind of sharing, you know, what he has prepared for today, and just doing his special thing that he does. So we're so appreciative of that. I do think we have water, tea, and coffee. This is very informal, so if you want something to drink, please help yourself. Okay. All right. Melinda?
All right. As you see on the agenda, our first speakers are from Harris County Health, and we are super excited to have them because it's always nice to get the latest and greatest on what's going on. And so, I don't know if y'all are all doing together, but we have Carolyn Embry and Arlene Cortez. They're both epidemiologists. And then we have Shaysana. Okay. And Ava. And so they're all going to give us some information, and if you, there's be a time for questions afterwards, so feel free to ask any questions. And let me get you there. Oh, what did I just do? Oh, there we go. Sorry. Okay.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for inviting us. Thank you, Melinda, for having us come and speak to the SHAC meeting today. We did have one change of presenter. Instead of Arlene, we had Cherry. Yeah, it was a last-minute change, but she was able to definitely step in for us. So today we were asked to present on flu, RSV, and COVID-19 updates. Carolyn Humphrey, she's the lead epidemiologist. She leads school investigations at our division. Sherry Hong, she is also an epidemiologist with Surveillance Epidemiology Unit. Abba Adhikari, she is an emergency management school liaison. And myself, Shazana Husseini, I am the epidemiologist liaison. I'm the one, mainly who communicates with Melinda on a regular basis for all our communications. Further ado, so this is an overview, of our presentation, just generally. We're going to go over some epidemiology updates, mainly covering flu and RSV. COVID-19, we're going to delve a little bit into long COVID is. We're also going to be doing school health and holiday recommendations, and then outbreak information. And then also we're going to end up with operational updates, our Harris County updates, COVID-19 vaccines and boosters, the flu vaccine, and also available resources from Harris County. And I'll turn it over to Sherry.
Hi everyone, sorry, I might be a little rough. I wasn't supposed to present today. We didn't choose to figure out until yesterday. But just FYI, we are divided into two different divisions. There's an infectious disease division, and then we have our own epidemiology division that deals with notifiable condition. Your school nurses are aware of us. And I'm part of the normal conditions unit. So just to let you guys know that there is a difference between our two teams, but we are working together. So just to start off, what influenza is, it is the flu, and it's a contagious respiratory illness caused by flu viruses that affect the nose, throat, and lungs. There's two main types. There's type A and type B that you guys might be aware of. CDC said that this year that type A is the most prevalent, is the most common found in the United States this year. And what's lucky is that this is what they were predicting in their vaccine. So if you guys were wondering about vaccine efficiency, it should be pretty efficient this year based on like our estimates of what was expected. But we don't have an exact number of how effective it is. It's normally between, I think it was about 20% to 60%, and they're expecting it closer to the 60% this year, even though the numbers aren't completely out. So besides that, nationally, seasonal influenza activity is elevated across the country, and it's also brought in an early flu season. This is what was also seen in Australia, and luckily in Australia, even though flu season started early, it ended early. So hopefully we will see the same thing, and it looks like we may be seeing the same thing because we did peak in early November, and then our flu numbers have just been dropping. So hopefully we're seeing the same trend as Australia. And also the most common strain is influenza A this year, which is luckily what they predicted in our vaccines. Unfortunately, this year vaccines have not been, we haven't had the same rate of vaccinations as previous year because of possibly vaccine hesitancy. So as school nurses or as the general public, we do recommend that you guys try to get vaccinated and try to push for other people to get vaccinated. And then just a disclaimer, the flu season started on October 1st. So if you were wondering why the chart started on October 1st, that's why. Next. So respiratory syncytial virus is RSV. It's something that you guys have been hearing in the news a lot. It's a common respiratory virus that usually causes mild to cold-like symptoms, and its most contagious form of bronchiolitis is inflammation of the lungs, basically, and pneumonia in children younger than 1 year of age in the United States. Right now, it seems to be remaining elevated, but luckily, CDC said that the rates have been decreasing in the South and in our general region, which is a good sign. And as you guys can see, we actually had an increase in June, and then so far we haven't had a rate at that level yet. At the most recent week that we have data for, 15% of 1,130 tests came back as positive, which is less than the peak we saw in May, which was 25%. And also, feel free to stop me if you guys have any questions. So we just wanted to provide some general information on RSV and flu. What's highlighted is the differences. So for RSV, the risk populations are infants under 6 months old, children that are less than 2 years old, and persons with weakened immune systems, such as having chronic lung disease or congenital heart disease, and older adults. The contagious period is what's a little bit different. You're normally contagious for 3 to 8 days after symptom onset, but for those that have a weakened immune system, they can be as contagious for up to 4 weeks. For flu, at-risk populations are mostly adults 65 years and older, those that are pregnant, younger children, such as children with neurological conditions, those with chronic conditions, asthma, heart disease, diabetes, HIV and AIDS, chronic kidney disease, and cancer. For flu, it can exacerbate these diseases, which is why we recommend using the vaccine, because they've seen that if you get the flu and you have a heart condition, it can cause you to have more severe heart complications after the flu. Yes, sir.
This question about RSV, so that any age can get that?
Yes.
Does the data show that it more happens in children than adults? Or?
So normally you get RSV normally when you're younger, and then you get over it, and then you normally have an immunity to RSV after that. So the worst outcomes normally happen to those that are younger because they've never experienced RSV, and then because we've caught RSV already, normally we don't have a bad reaction as those that are younger. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And when you go to the doctor, I know the flu, there's a test that you can run. How do you find out if the child has RSV?
So RSV, that's normally a test as well. So
oh, there's a test.
Yes. So this is actually a testing date. Lab data from RSV test. Unfortunately, if you guys can see in a couple of slides, the symptoms for RSV and flu are really similar. So the only way we can tell that's RSV is if you do the test.
Okay. They do that at the beginning of the
test. Yes. And then, we don't have the symptoms. Sorry. So basically, this is general information, but like we said, the only way you can tell if it's RSV is if you get testing done. However, unfortunately, transmission for these two diseases are similar because they're both respiratory diseases. So mostly it's from indirect contact, such as if an infected person coughs, sneezes, or talks, the virus droplet can land in your eyes, nose, or mouth. Or if you touch a surface, which this is really rare, if you touch a surface that has the virus and then you touch your face before washing your hands, that's another way of transmitting it. Another method is through direct contact, such as kissing the face of a child with respiratory illness. And that's this was very specific to RSV because mostly RSV is shows up more with little children, or the symptom of RSV shows up more with little children. And so with transmission, we have preventions. So most of them are covering coughs and sneeze, so it doesn't spread to someone that's farther away from you. And also hand washing. Make sure to avoid close contact, such as kissing, shaking hands, or sharing cups, and eating utensils with others when you're sick. And clean frequently touched surfaces, such as doorknobs and mobile devices. For cleaning, I know a lot of nurses have been wondering how the school should clean after a flu outbreak. And CDC states that for a flu outbreak, the virus luckily is very delicate, so any general cleaning methods that you guys normally use should be able to kill off the virus. So you guys don't have to close out the school and do a deep clean. That's not necessary for flu. And CDC in general does not recommend you shutting down the school just because there's a flu outbreak. Another thing that you guys might be interested in is if what's defined as a flu outbreak. A flu outbreak right now is considered 5 cases that are linked in some way, such as if they are on a sports team together, in a classroom together. So that's one definition. The other definition, which is a little bit more complicated, is if you guys have more cases than the general baseline. And I'll go touch on that a little bit. Also, another recommendation that you guys all know right now is to stay home for at least 24 hours after your fever is gone. The fever should be gone without the need of using a fever-reducing medication. And you should only leave the house if you need to seek medical care. And this is important because the fever is normally when you start becoming infectious, so that's why we recommend you stay at home. For school specifically, we really, really recommend that you don't use the perfect attendance policy because that may, like, force students to be like, oh, I need to keep this attendance, perfect attendance, like, I need to go to school. So we just try to recommend you being flexible with the students to try to help them stay home, to try to prevent others from getting sick, and also the staff as well. We try to recommend you guys giving support to your staff, such as cross-training staff, so you don't have one specialist in one area, and they do everything, and then they feel like, oh, I have to be at school because I'm the only one that knows how to do it. So we recommend that you guys trying to be most flexible with, like, your staff and students and try to help them stay home if they can stay home and not feel the need to go to school. Another thing we highly recommend is vaccination. RSV, there isn't a vaccination yet, but they're pushing through the clinical trials, and hopefully the vaccine should be out by next year if everything goes as predicted. And then the flu, there is a vaccine, and like I said, even though we don't have efficacy data for this year, luckily what was predicted and is what's currently in the vaccine match, so it should be very good for this year, and hopefully it will decrease the hospitalization rates and negative impact of flu for this year. So next we're going to be talking about the flu portal. This is basically a data source that we use in the public health side, and it's generated by the school nurses. So basically, the flu portal is where the school nurse inputs data on students that are sick, students that are absent, and students that have were told that had flu. So they input all this data in, and basically it allows the school nurse to track the trends. Like, oh, is there an increase in absenteeism? Is there an increase in flu? And this is really important for an outbreak because we can tell if there's an significant increase in absences due to flu, and then that will generate guidance. It's like, okay, this is what you guys should do. You guys should increase education on the flu. You guys should put out notices to parents, like, hey, like, if your student's sick, please have them have your student out of school for 24 hours, blah, blah, blah. Just, like, more education, more guidance. It's like, oh, maybe your student should also get tested for the flu because this student got tested. And also, like, just a lot of other prevention measures to try to stop the flu from being spread. But also, it allows us to help the public as well because, unfortunately, flu is not a notifiable condition, so a lot of the data that we have is based on the information the school nurses provide for us. So, basically, thank you, school nurses, for, like, reporting because you guys help our public health needs, because this data also leads to action on our end because it pushes out, like, oh, these are the schools that need these are the zip codes that need vaccine clinics that we can, and so we can provide free vaccines. And it basically helps us also send out, like, education through our social media accounts as well. So it does also help the public as well, and not just the school nurses. And it also helps you guys gauge, like, where your trends is. Like, oh, we always see, like, there's an increase in November. Let's do something about it. So you can see historical data, and also you can see if your levels are increasing as well, similar as the Harris County data and your school district area. And if you guys have any questions, if you guys want to join, please let us know. It's only for school nurses, but please feel free to send us an email. And if you ever want us to analyze this data for you, it's like, oh, is there, like, I think it's there's an increase, but I'm not sure. We can analyze it for you through our databases.
Hi all, I'm Carolyn. So I'll just go over some general COVID updates for what we have going on. So if you aren't familiar, these are our COVID-19 community levels. It's basically the system that the CDC uses to kind of help people figure out what actions they should take, especially if they live with or work with anyone at risk. So right now, and I'm going to tell you this is probably going to change Thursday, We are in the green level, which means, you know, transmission is low, especially by case numbers, hospitalizations aren't too bad. But looking at wastewater data we have from the state of Houston, I can tell you if we had more testing, we'd probably already be in yellow. And hospitalization numbers are about to cross that threshold and move to yellow, too. And considering that COVID hospitalizations are up, we still have a lot of people in hospitals for flu and RSV. It is kind of a rough spot right now for our hospital systems. So, I would just say if you're going to be doing things for the holiday, you might want to consider who you're going to be with, if you want to wear a mask in crowded areas. That way you can enjoy your holiday and hopefully avoid getting sick. So, next slide here. Wastewater. So we use wastewater data. Right now it's just the incorporated part of the city to kind of see trends going on in the community. Right now it just measures COVID-19, but we are planning to first start our own for unincorporated Harris County in these areas, and we can then later on also use this to look at other things, other illnesses that could be in there, because, you know, maybe people don't test, but everyone has to go to the bathroom. And we can see what is in that wastewater to understand how bad the disease burden is in the community. So, well, I see one number I forgot to update. But this is the update as of Monday over here in these boxes. It's 340% of when they started measuring in July of 2020. So we're about 3.5 times higher. This has been trending up for a couple weeks now, so you can see we are definitely going up. Our new admissions per 100,000, this is number updates every Thursday. It's 8.7. When it hits 10, that triggers us moving into the yellow level, regardless of how many cases per 100,000 we have. So that's the number I'm expecting to go up here in the next few weeks. And hospital usage has been going up, too. This is just COVID alone, so it doesn't factor in how bad it is in our hospitals right now with flu and anything else that could be happening. So, moving on from there, you may have been hearing more, as we have for the past 3 years, about variants. The good news with the variants that are coming to become more dominant right now is, you know, a few weeks ago we got that updated booster, the bivalent one, which means it protects against the original version of COVID and Omicron BA5. These up here, BQ1, BQ1.1, XBB, are offshoots of Omicron. Particularly BQ1 and BQ1.1 are like direct descendants of BA5. So even if we're getting some new variants taking over, they're pretty closely related, and we're still expecting that booster to be very effective. So if you haven't gotten boosted yet, we go ahead and strongly encourage you to do so, especially because it does take a couple weeks for your immune system to kind of retrain for the new version of this variant. XBB, that's one that's kind of coming up too in the U.S. It wasn't really in the U.S. too much few weeks ago, but it doesn't look like it's probably going to take over. If it does, though, but seems unlikely, again, the vaccine will cover it really well. Go ahead.
Just a question about that booster. If you did get that booster, how long do you have to wait to get that again?
So if you got the original boosters, you should by this point be able to kind of go ahead and get the updated one. They recommend doing this updated one, the bivalent one. They haven't authorized like a second dose yet, but what I kind of expect is it might be an annual thing depending on how much this thing evolves. So if it slows down its evolution, we'll see. If it keeps going as it is, we might have an annual booster that we need to get, like the flu. And I know they're also looking doing some combined shots for flu and COVID at once. That way you don't have to go and get so many shots, because I think everyone's kind of getting a bit of vaccine fatigue, for sure. Other news to know about these, though, is probably the more concerning one for those who are high risk or not vaccinated, is monoclonal antibodies aren't working really well against these anymore, so they're not recommended for use now. Things like Paxlovid are still available to use. That's one you'll take at home if you're hospitalized already, your symptoms are too bad to be using Paxlovid. But if you're high risk, and start that within 5 days of your symptoms, it's pretty effective at reducing your chances of ending up in the hospital, reducing symptom severity, and it also has been recently shown it might reduce the chance you develop something called long COVID. So, long COVID. I'll touch on this briefly. We actually have a team who's studying kind of the long-term impacts on the county and how we can help the county recover from COVID, but they're also studying long COVID and like how widespread it is in our community, what kind of services and support we might need. Luckily, since we have the Texas Medical Center, we actually have a lot of clinics, and this is pretty unique in the country, that can help people with long COVID. So long COVID is basically if you have symptoms persisting 4 weeks after infection, or you have kind of like new and unusual symptoms showing up after you've already gotten better. So like maybe after you recover, you're just having a lot of struggles with sleep problems. Maybe you've had brain fog or you're really fatigued. So this it seems to be able to happen to anyone, even if your infection is pretty mild. Some of these are more likely to happen if you're like hospitalized, like organ damage. And it seems to be happening in about 1 in 4 people, and that holds true with children. Now, some of these symptoms will go away after a few weeks, like maybe you had loss of smell and taste that lasted for a few months, and eventually that can go away. Some of the more severe symptoms, like organ damage, of course, are going to have longer-lasting impacts. So if the symptoms of long COVID are at a rate where they are like significantly impacting your life and your ability to function, they do qualify under the ADA for certain like protections and plans to help out those students. So if you know a student who, or you have a student who's got long COVID, maybe they're not doing well athletically anymore, maybe they're a really bright student before and now they're kind of declined academically, they're having some behavioral issues, there are, you know, some supports you can get in there, like maybe extra test time, maybe helping them in gym classes to have like easier exercises to help them get back up into shape. And if you want to learn more about that, again, we have our long COVID team who's available to come and talk about this in a lot more detail. They've been working on it for a long time. They can share with you a lot more. Okay. Next. So just generally taking into account flu, COVID, RSV, all the other respiratory illnesses that are going on out there. Some things you can do in your schools is to, of course, continue routinely cleaning. As Sherry mentioned, most of these are easily kind of killed by the general disinfectants you're going to have in your classrooms and schools already. It's a good idea to go ahead, especially the little kids, to remind them this time of year of good respiratory etiquette. So you might do things like maybe some story time about germs, reminding them of good hand washing, using some songs there. You can also look to make some indoor air quality improvements, so HEPA filters are really great. We've been showing that, you know, good ventilation in classrooms is a really good tool to prevent illness spread. And of course, encouraging people to stay home if sick. If they like have very light symptoms or sniffles, maybe consider wearing a mask when they're out among others. And reviewing school policies just to help promote people to stay home when they're sick if they can. So reconsidering if you've got perfect attendance policies, though, and being sure that there are some staff, as Jerry mentioned, who are cross-trained who can jump in and help. holiday health recommendations. You saw we're probably going to be moving up in severity, so we kind of like to think of it as planning with your most vulnerable family member in mind. So, like myself, I'm going to be visiting my sister-in-law. She's like 8 months pregnant. Definitely want to be sure she's healthy and not miserable there in her last bit of pregnancy. So, we're just planning to test when we go visit her, wear a mask when boarding the plane, just so we don't bring anything to her and her other two small children and get them all sick. So, you know, stay home and sick. If you're going to be with someone who's high risk, consider testing for gatherings, especially if you have symptoms. Be sure you get those updated flu shots, the sooner the better. That way you have higher protection when you go out and do these celebrations. If feasible, you can go and do celebrations outdoors. We got a good ventilation. School holiday parties, again, you know, remind kids what they should be doing with their hands. Throw away tissues, wash after you've been sneezing. And then travel. Travel, again, you know, try to stay home if you're sick. If you don't want to wear a mask the whole time, probably the most important time to wear a mask are going to be when you're boarding and deplaning because the ventilation systems are not turned on. So that's when you're going to be breathing in everyone's air until you start to take off and they turn it back on. Reporting, if you ever have outbreaks, as I mentioned, for flu, COVID, anything else that you're concerned, about. Again, you can report them to us. Like, flu and RSV aren't reportable conditions. If you're seeing a big uptick in illness, anything unusual, you can reach out to us at any time, or we can kind of help you look into that, make some recommendations, and help you kind of monitor that outbreak. So you don't have to wait until you think you've got one. You can just get in contact with us beforehand, and we'll go to help you guys out with that. And outbreak definitions. They're a little bit different for COVID and other respiratory illnesses. So Sherry covered the general respiratory illnesses, which are, you know, a sudden increase in absenteeism or at least 5 linked cases, so shared classroom or other activity. COVID, right now, is at least 2 or more cases linked. So if they're in the same classroom, it's just a lower threshold at this time, unless the state decides to revise that. Any questions for this section?
I will stop and want to find you stuff. And I also apologize. I am getting over a sickness. I don't know what it is. It's not COVID. It's not flu. It's not RSV. I lost my voice. So I will try my best to not have a coughing fit in the middle of it, but if I do, I apologize. And just a quick update for you guys. So we actually are now moving into a whole division. So we're all going to be together. We used to just be the COVID division, but now we're going to be under Office of Epidemiology, Surveillance, and Emergent Diseases. And what that basically means for y'all is that just expect a little bit more communication in terms of other diseases too. So anything new or emerging that might be impacting us, any ILI, so like Sherry was saying, flu, RSV, so not just COVID. I know you guys are probably sick and tired of hearing from us about COVID, so just expect a little bit more guidance, resources for disease mitigation, or any other emergent diseases or threats. And a quick update on operations. So I'm a school liaison, meaning I do all of the operation stuff, so vaccines, testing, any resources for schools like antigen testing kits and all of that. So right now we are offering combined events at all of our COVID-19 sites for vaccines. So what that means is we do monkeypox, COVID-19, and flu vaccines that are available. They are free of cost to everybody. You don't need to have insurance to come in for it. You don't need to have really any information. You can just come in, get vaccinated. We have all of the boosters. So, you know, if you do want to come in and get vaccinated, you can look up one of our sites, or we can actually come and host it at one of your schools. So depending on whatever campus you want to have us at, you know, get in touch with me. We can schedule a site for you guys. You can have students, staff, parents, admin, just depending on, you know, whoever you guys want to open it up to. And then same thing for testing sites, too. They're also free, and we can hold them at your schools. It can be like a one-day event, or we can do a recurring event, kind of like a screening event, which is something I definitely recommend, especially as we kind of come back from the holidays, you know, with children being out and about, traveling, and all of that. Would be a good idea to have a few of those screening events at different campuses. So.
I have a question. So how are we, as parents, will get the information how our campus is doing with those, like a flu cases? Because right now we haven't received any news from others. Does that mean that our campus is okay, or if they just not communicating with the parents yet?
So I would say that would really depend on your school. I think Melinda might have a better answer for that, because we're really just going between free school and Harris County in terms of what's specifically happening at every campus. Probably your nurse at the school would have a better answer for that.
So we should approach our nurse and ask that information.
Yes. Oh. I think so. Is that right, Melinda?
Yes,
I
would have a better.
But we also do have, as Carolyn was saying, a sort of a community outlook. That's kind of an overview of Harris County. Those of us that can go, you know, at every specific school. I know we used to have the COVID like numbers on dashboards beforehand, but I know we've kind of discontinued the use of it as community levels have been fairly low. But yeah, if there's definitely a concern, I would probably see our school nurse would be your best bet for that. And then in terms of vaccines, so we have Pfizer, Moderna, and Novavax at all of our sites. Johnson & Johnson is approved and authorized, but we do not carry it just because it had the very rare sort of misfortune. I'm not going to go into it, but we don't carry it at our sites. And with Pfizer and Moderna and Novavax, there are 2-dose series. Pfizer and Moderna are both for 6 months and older, and then Novavax right now is approved for 12 years and older. And then in terms of boosters, I know there's been quite a lot of updates and confusion, so I'm going to quickly go over it, but we now have the bivalent boosters also available at our site, and they're called bivalent, as Carolyn was saying, because they have a more sort of widespread protection against all of the circulating variants and also against the original strain of COVID. So very good protection for you, and the general rule of thumb is after your primary series, regardless of whether you've been boosted before, had two boosters, one booster, if it's been at least 2 months after that, you are eligible to get the bivalent booster dose. So updates for that, this is the newest one that CDC came out with on Friday last week. So as of Friday, the boosters are actually approved for 6 months to 4 years if you have the Pfizer booster, Moderna for 6 years to 5 years, and Novavax is still 18 years or older. And again, we do carry them all at our sites, and if it's been 2 months, at least 2 months after your original series or after your latest shot, again, you're eligible for it. I put that up there just so it kind of simplifies a little bit. I don't know if it does. I know it's very confusing, but again, general rule of thumb is 2 months after your latest shot, you're eligible to get the bivalent booster. Any questions?
I have a question. Do they have any recommendations on, like, if you had the Pfizer vaccine first, if you should get the Pfizer booster or the Moderna booster, or does it matter?
So you can mix and match. I know a lot of people prefer to kind of keep with Pfizer if they got the Pfizer, but, I mean, if you go to a site and for whatever reason they only have the Moderna but you got the Pfizer, you can mix and match.
Okay.
And again, we do have all of these just depending on, you know, what your preference is. Moderna and Pfizer are your mRNA vaccines. Novavax is considered your more traditional vaccine. So just depending on whatever your preference is, they're all equally safe. They're all equally effective. And then for flu, again, we do carry the flu vaccines as well. They are recommended for everybody 6 months and older. There's a few different types. There's not really a specific preference for anybody under the age of 65 for flu vaccines, but if you are over 65 and you prefer a specific one, you can ask for them at our site as well. And this is my information, so if you guys do want to get in touch with me about, you know, setting up a site at one of your schools for vaccine or testing, please feel free to email me, or you can call me as well. Email is better. I might miss a call. I might not be able to call you guys back, so email is always the best. I think Melinda has these slides, so she can send it out to you guys if you do need it. But again, it's free of cost for attendance, site breakdown, setup is all handled by our staff. We just really need like a space that you guys are able to provide, kind of partner with us, come in and set these events. And again, they can be a one-time or recurring event for both vaccines and testing. And lastly, thank you again for inviting us to your SHAC meetings. We are available to present and attend more of these. We've done this year with Sheldon ISD, so if you do have availability and you want us out in your next SHAC meeting, do let us know. We are able to come in and present on any topic that you guys want. And that is our contact information for Carolyn. She is, again, the COVID epi. Myself, I'm over the operations part. Shazana, who is your epi liaison, and then for the epidemiology task force, so that's for flu, general kind of reporting questions that are not COVID-related.
And so it can be for anything as well, like we've taken care of mumps outbreaks, pertussis, like for the younger ones as well, so anything that's like reportable or any conditions you guys are worried about, feel free to contact us because we are, like, we're even GI symptoms as well, or GI illness.
Just curious, if there are two different strains of flu, why do we vaccinate only for one?
So it's not just a vaccination for one. Every year they predict what flu strains will be most prevalent. So there's two types. There's type A and type B, and then there's sub-variants between each one. It's a lot that goes on to try to guess what's in the vaccine each year. They take data from Australia, who has an earlier flu season than us. They also look at previous, like, strains from, like, our previous season as well, and then they try to estimate, okay, what strain's going to be in for this season. And from what their guesses were, they were pretty correct from what I've seen in CDC protocol, so that's how they predicted that it would be, they would predict the A, it's been A, and it, they also guess the subtype from what I understand from the calls. So that's where they're saying that it's pretty, it should be pretty efficient this year.
And generally with vaccinations, they give you a more like widespread immunity anyway to be able to deal with it. So regardless of usually what strain is around, it's always a good idea to get the flu vaccine.
And there's four strains in this flu vaccine this year. And there's different types as well, depending on like, there's some that are more, have higher dosage for those that that need like more effectiveness. But then there's also those that have like compromised immune system and they can only handle a certain dosage, so there's a lower dosage as well. So they have everything basically covered to, so everyone can get vaccinated.
If not, again, you can always contact us, and we are more than happy to answer you guys. Again, thank you guys so much for having us out here. I will give the clicker back to whoever was next.
No, round of applause. Very interesting. Okay, it may just be me, but this is an opportunity, mind over matter. Your mind is very strong. You start seeing all those things about, you know, being sick and whatnot, and like, oh my gosh, I don't feel good. That's not it. What I want to do just for a few minutes is what we call in our field just chew time. You just got a lot of information, a lot of pertinent information, obviously for your children in school, but any and every gathering that we're going to have, because generally over the holidays, we're around a lot of people. My wife and I just recently flew, and I wore my mask on the plane, but I'm glad I heard what I did, because I should have left it on until I got off the plane because that airflow. But what we want to do is just give you a few minutes at the table, and if you're by yourself, I would encourage you just to move over to where you have at least a partner, where you can just talk, what did you learn from this? What was beneficial? And just take some time to share that, and then quickly I'm just going to ask if anybody, four or five people throughout the room, just to share what was your takeaway. Okay, just a couple of minutes. Talk about what you learned.
My brother and my brother.
Water testing, and y'all will get this presentation. So I saw somebody taking copious notes. You'll get that, so that'll be good for that. And that was something I didn't know about. We're eager to learn more. Thank you. Others? Yes, I'm going to hit every table.
I would say the RSV vaccine is coming out.
RSV vaccine coming that way. You're hearing a lot about RSV, so that's good to know that the response and what will take place with that. Two more tables.
I think for us, it's just there's things that are working just for different individuals, and as long as we just keep working our own path, that we can continue to, you know,
sure,
be healthy.
Yeah, everything's not in our control, but there is a lot, and those are my words, not hers, but just trying to, whatever we're doing individually, and then we're just so many reminders, and I was like, oh my gosh, I shouldn't have, you know, scratched my face just a few minutes ago, and, you know, just all those things you think about, but it is constantly trying, just to what we already know, but we get so busy sometimes we forget about that. And our final table.
I thought it was a very interesting tidbit about the four strains in the flu vaccine.
Yeah.
Heard that.
And again, just thinking personally, I really have to think back, okay, I knew I got that COVID booster, but it is a lot of vaccines, and it was good to hear that perhaps there'll be the flu and the COVID all in one. And then shingles, you know, I got that one. And then just thinking, keeping up with everything. Maybe there's a system that, you know, we can help the Roys out in the world. And, okay, which one did I get? And get an alert on our phone. It's time for your vaccine, or, you know, whatever. Anything else from this side of the room?
What you just said about the system. You know, when we were young, or for our children, we get those vaccinations, those lists that turn into schools. But, you know, I sent off, at some point during all of this, I sent off to CVS or wherever you get your vaccines, if you get them mostly at one place, they can send you a record if you can get that. And so I have that in my whole family because I am a bit of a, I probably go overboard. I'm sitting by myself because I left my mask in the car because I still mask up. So, yeah. I
loved it. Well, and I think that's one thing that we've been more accepting of what, you know, whatever individual wants to do that feels comfortable. And I think that's important too. You know, back to wearing masks and wherever you go. I referenced, we flew not too long ago and saw a lot of masks wearing, you know, and it's all I did. It's really, as we know, it's that individual to make that decision on what he or she wants to do. But thank you again. Just so much information. Again, you'll get a copy of that PowerPoint. Nice takeaways, especially when we have the holidays coming in. It moves from the school where we've got 118,000 in 93 different buildings to all over the community and in our homes, but we still you know, something that I started doing, and I'll do this time. We've got guests coming in. We've got those pretty Christmas towels in the restroom, but we've always got paper towels there too, so people can just use that, because everybody using that same towel to dry their hands, I mean, that doesn't make sense if you think about it, because, well, you know the rest of the story on that. We've experienced that a couple of years ago too, with a little bug going around. Wasn't COVID, but just a bug, and how did that happen? Could have been that towel. So, get some paper towels, all right? Melinda.
All right. Next up, we have Katie Nippris from Gulf Coast Regional Blood Center. She came and actually talked at our health services department meeting last month, and it was the nurses loved it. It was great information, and so I thought it would be great if she shared with the Shack. Let's see. There you are. Okay, perfect. So my name is Katie, and happy to be here today. I wanted to share with you all a little bit about what's going on with the Blood Center. Okay, so Gulf Coast Regional Blood Center is a community-based blood bank. And so our job is to go out into the community every single day and collect 1,000 units of blood 7 days a week just for the greater Houston area. It's about 170 different hospitals and healthcare facilities in the Houston, surrounding cities, out to College Station, Lufkin and Nacogdoches, but just the greater Houston area, basically. And so we go out into the community, we partner with everyone to host blood drives. We have neighborhood donor centers where we invite the public to come in and donate blood. And we are really, really struggling to get enough blood on the shelf. But the Harris County Medical Society got together in 1975 and formed Gulf Coast Regional Blood Center to be that solution for the community. So in the past, prior to that, hospitals would collect blood specifically for their hospital. And you never know when an accident is going to happen or what your personal emergency might be, what your child might need, where they're going to end up at the hospital. So we want to make sure that all of the hospitals have the blood they need and they have equal access to the blood supply. So Gulf Coast Regional Blood Center was formed to be that community blood center. We transport blood to the hospitals as needed, so we have standing requests from hospitals every day. They have that request they send us if a major crisis happens and we need to move blood around. And we have teams that are out in the community driving around 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We'll have teams on Christmas ready to transport blood wherever it's needed, but we also move it around. So some of the small rural hospitals, for example, Columbus Community Hospital, they might not be going through blood as quickly as Benthoff, right? So we take those fresh units out to smaller hospitals where they can sit on the shelf for a little bit, and then we go and swap them out. And we'll, after they've been on the shelf for a few days, we can move them to Benthoff where they're going to fly off the shelf quickly, and that way nothing ever gets wasted. Okay, so that's our role in the community, to support all of the hospitals. And yeah, these are the 26 counties that we serve, and there are a couple of hospitals that collect a little bit of blood. MD Anderson has some blood drives also for their hospitals. They're collecting blood just to supplement what we provide to them also. Okay. Most of the hospitals no longer have a system for collecting blood, so we provide 100% of the blood, like to Memorial Hermann, Texas Children's, Benthoff, all the other hospitals. And of course, anyone could need blood at any time. So it's very important to make sure that we have a strong blood supply on the shelf all the time. We struggle to keep just a 1 to 2 day blood supply on the shelf. So that's kind of concerning, right? At any given time, we only have about a 2 day supply of blood. Maybe if we're doing really well, we get up to a 3 day supply of blood. But anything could happen. We could have another ice day that, you know, shuts down our collections for the day. No one can get out on the streets to get blood. Our teams can't get out. We don't collect 1,000 units of blood that day, and we fall a whole day behind with no way to make that up. So we're just constantly trying to build up that supply, make sure that we have enough blood on the shelf at all times. And we've also joined the Blood Emergency Readiness Corps. It's called BERC. So BERC is a national program just recently developed to provide blood when there are big emergencies and a lot of blood is needed. So for example, when Hurricane Harvey hit, we had a 1 or 2 day supply of blood on the shelf. I'm sure everyone remembers, you couldn't get out on the streets, the roads were flooded, everything was shut down, people didn't have power. We did get up and running in about 4 days to have some blood drive, and the community came out. If their area was not damaged, the community came out in large numbers, but that was still 4 days with no blood. And we actually had, I have a picture somewhere, we actually had our teams driving blood as far as they could to the hospital. And then the roads were so flooded. I have a picture of a guy walking out into the water, carrying a cooler of blood over his head. It's waist deep, trying to get it to a hospital for someone who was having a transplant. And once they finally got their match and it was time for their transplant, they couldn't wait. They had to go through with it, right? So we had to have blood available. So for these types of emergencies, when that happened with Hurricane Harvey, other blood centers kind of got together around the nation. They said, we want to help. If we have extra available, we have to take care of our cities. But they did try to get blood to us as soon as possible. And, of course, there were challenges with that because the airports were shut down, the roads were flooded, so it was still hard to get blood here. So we have a blood emergency readiness corps now that we're members of. There are various weeks throughout the year where different blood centers are on call so that if there is a major emergency, they have units set aside to pool together to supply blood for that emergency in any city in the U.S. Okay. So when the next hurricane hits, we'll have a resource available so that we'll know that there are units on reserve specifically for an emergency that week. And of course, all of our blood donors in the U.S. must be unpaid volunteers. And every 2 seconds, someone is needing a blood transfusion. So it's a huge, huge ongoing need. These are a few stories that are local to Five Bear. Stephanie is a student at Lone Star College. She's a sophomore. And then the little boy Samuel is the little brother of a student at Lone Star College. Both of them needing blood transfusions. We actually had a blood drive in their honor at Lone Star College. It's coming up in January, so they're still recruiting for that. But if you know of anyone who needs blood, or you know these personal stories, we would love for you to reach out and share them with us. Of course, we connect with the families if they're willing to share that story, if they're willing to share a photo and a few words about what's going on, and host a blood drive in their honor to help bring in blood, to help spread awareness, put a face to what it means to donate blood. Everyone knows it's a good thing, but when you look at this little boy and know that he wouldn't be here without blood on the shelf, it helps to bring the community out. So we like to share those stories. These are three students at Cy Falls, all three of them battling cancer, different kinds of cancer, and all three of them needing blood donations. So Nikki, Kayla, and William. And we had a blood drive in their honor in November. And the kids came out in huge numbers. We had a very full schedule that day. Lots of donors. They had over 100 kids come out and donate blood. The minimum age to donate is 16. So 16, 17, 18-year-olds on their campus coming out to give blood for their peers. And it was something great that they could do to give back, show support for those families, and let them know that their fellow students and their district is behind them. And then, of course, this is Zoe. Has anyone heard about Zoe Moody in Bridgeland?
Yeah.
Zoe was on her way to homecoming, and she was in a terrible accident, and she's been through a long recovery, and she's still going through recovery. She used a lot of blood. She is having to learn to walk again, and was hospitalized for months. And so we've been hosting blood drives in honor of Zoe in the Bridgeland area also. And some of the churches and neighborhoods, and of course her family is just so appreciative that blood was on the shelf. She made it through. She has a long recovery ahead. She has, lots of therapy, but she's here today and she should make a full recovery.
just some more statistics to share with you. About 1 in 7 people entering the hospital is going to need blood. That's 4.5 million Americans every single year. About 42,000 blood components are used by patients every day. So that could be red cells, plasma, platelets. Different patients are needing blood for different reasons. And then about 62% of the population is eligible to donate blood, but only 3% of those people ever actually give blood. So we have lots and lots of people that are eligible to donate blood. We have a hard time getting the word out and motivating everyone to come out, roll up their sleeve, one little needle stick, but it will save someone's life. So we're looking for advocates to go out in the community, host blood drives at churches, at your business, at your neighborhood, in your school, wherever you can to advocate for blood donations and get the word out and make sure that we have a strong and stable blood supply available for everyone. Okay. This is Jack's story, and I wanted to let his family tell a little bit more about his story, so hopefully this link will work. You can all watch it, but Jack has been battling cancer. His mom talked about what it was like to just take him to the doctor. She was actually going to take his brother to the doctor, but he wasn't feeling well. She brought him in also, and the doctor said, we'll see the brother at a later time. We needed to get Jack to Texas Children's immediately, and found out that he had leukemia. And Jack is just a fun little kid. He battled it so bravely. He made everyone laugh. And he says in the video, you can never stop the fun. He just had such a great attitude battling so much at such a young age. And he is now, now we're not working. Let's see. No.
Advance
the slide.
Fine.
Well, I can help.
What
heck?
Oh, I have to like the touch screen, and I don't think that it is. We should.
Oh, I'm about to mess something up. I have a feeling, aren't I?
Oh, no.
I'm
can
not.
You press escape and see that?
Well, yeah, that is working. Well, we're just a mess, aren't we? Okay, or not. Oh, this is it. Now try. Okay. There.
Okay. Jack got lots of blood transfusions. He got through his chemotherapy. This is a parade we had in the neighborhood. Of course, we wanted to keep him safe and not expose him to a lot of different people once he finally got to ring the bell. But Jack got to go home. He is in remission. They had a whole parade through his neighborhood to welcome him back. We brought the blood donor bus out there, and he's here today because people gave blood and helped get him through that chemotherapy that saved his life. So I wanted to talk a little bit about COVID and how that impacted blood donations also. Of course, it turned everyone's life upside down, right? And everything changed for all of us. Along with that, blood donations were severely impacted, and nationwide it continues to be a struggle. So many people work changed, and so many people are working hybrid schedules. They're working from home, working remotely. They have that flexibility more now than ever, and it makes it really hard for us to have blood drives when everyone's at home. So we would have huge corporate blood drives in the past, and they're just not seeing as many donors now because people have the flexibility to work from home. Unfortunately, we can't do blood donations through Zoom, so we are struggling to find solutions, partnering with schools, partnering with churches, partnering with neighborhoods, and people are working from home. Maybe they can go donate in their neighborhood. But we're looking for ideas, and we're looking for more partners to help make sure that we're able to keep blood on the shelf. Okay. We ask everyone to donate regularly, to stay connected with us, and to help spread the word about the need for blood donations. So that is our Commit for Life program. You've probably seen Commit for Life all over our blood donor buses and all over the advertisements and everything, but that's what we need. We need our donors to donate regularly, stay connected with us, and help spread the word and advocate in the community. If all of the donors that gave this year just gave twice instead of once, we would have an abundant blood supply. If those that gave two times gave three times, we would have plenty of blood on the shelf all the time. But the vast majority of people don't even give once a year if they give blood, and only 3% of those that are eligible are donating at all. So that's the problem we have. We have all kinds of incentives for donors. We have a point system. So not only do we have giveaways at the drive, but they earn points each time they donate blood. They earn points for scheduling and keeping their appointments so that we can let the hospitals know every day how many people are going to come in. We have a great incentive program. We have an app, and they earn all of these points. They log into the app, and you can cash those out immediately for gift cards. So Starbucks gift card, Target gift card, Amazon gift card. You do have to save up points with each donation because, of course, we're a nonprofit. But you save up those points, earn them, cash them out, and you get a QR code that you can use instantly. And I don't think Ethan's story will work either, but this is Ethan, and he is the cutest. So when you get the link, please be sure and watch the story. Ethan is the cutest. He has an interview with his mom, and he's only about 4 years old, and he talks about being a leukemia battler, and he says, I'm strong, and I'm brave, and I have to go in and take the needle, but it only takes a few minutes, and then he says, woohoo, I'm done. And I just think that's so awesome that at 4 years old, he's able to be strong and brave and take a needle, and woohoo, he's done in a few minutes. We can all do that, right? If it's going to save someone's life, if he can do it at 4 years old, we can do that for him. So this year, we are kicking off the FICAR ISD Blood Drive Challenge, and we're encouraging all of the schools to host at least one blood drive this year for Gulf Coast Regional Blood Center to help get blood on the shelves. And we're making it a fun competition between the schools to see who can save the most lives at the end of the school year. Something we did in Katy ISD in the last couple of years, and their donations tripled over a couple of years. Just making it a fun contest to see who can save the most lives. We'll come out at the end of the year. We'll present trophies and awards to all of the winning schools. But we want to encourage everyone to get involved, save some lives. Even if you're not first place, we have some schools that are very, very competitive. Even if you're not first place, if you have a blood drive that 15 people come out and donate, that saves about 3 lives per donation, and that's 45 more people, 45 more lives saved. So we would love to get all of the campuses involved in hosting. We also have a great scholarship program. So every year we give away scholarships to high school seniors at schools that are hosting at least 2 blood drives a year. We're giving away $60,000 in scholarships. We don't care what they're studying, where they're going to school, any institution of higher learning. It could be a trade school. The top award is $10,000. We have 2 $5,000 scholarships, and then 40 scholarships for $1,000. So we like to go out to the high schools and host blood drives. We like to get them started coordinating the blood drives. So we like to work with HOSA or another student organization on campus, maybe NHS or Student Council, and have the kids take leadership of hosting the blood drive, recruiting their peers, educating everyone, so that they learn the importance of donating blood and doing community service, and they get some leadership skills to put on college applications. And that is the best way to educate our future blood donors and make sure that we continue to have blood on the shelf. We also give out red cords to seniors who donate at least twice in their senior year. So that's a great incentive for all of the seniors. Come out, donate blood twice, and we'll bring your red cord. You can wear at graduation. If the school doesn't allow them at graduation, they can at least have them for photos and recognition. Okay. And then, of course, we have great giveaways at all of our blood drives, too, to incentivize blood donors. Right now, at all of our blood drives, you get to pick what you want. So we have T-shirts and beach towels and socks and fanny packs. Everyone who comes in and donates blood gets to choose what they would like. We're also doing holiday hug fairs all the way through the end of December. And so every donor is invited to write a little note to a patient that's receiving blood or spending the holidays in the hospital. And we attach their note, the donor's note, to these soft little teddy bears. We take them around to the children's hospital and deliver them in the donor's name. Okay. In January, we'll be giving away hoodies the first couple of weeks of January, as well as the last couple of weeks of December. Those are the toughest times to keep blood on the shelf. Everyone gets busy with holidays. Schools are closed. It's a really tough time to have a blood drive and get people out. So we give out great hoodies. It's our best giveaway every year. Everyone loves them, but you have to donate through the holidays to get them. And then the rest of January, we'll have T-shirts to give away, as well as everyone will get a free entree from Black Bear Diner. Yeah, so, and we'll continue to have giveaways throughout the year, so whenever you host a drive, we'll have something to give away. But the closer it is to a holiday, most likely the better the giveaway is going to be. Because that's our most critical time. And so what does it take to host a blood drive? All we need is a site to come out and someone to be an advocate and help sign people up to donate. So we can bring out our donor bus. It takes about 8 parking spaces or 50 feet of parking space. Everything happens on the bus. All we need is access to restrooms inside the building, but everything else happens on the bus. Or we can set up in a room like this. We just actually just had a blood drive December 6th here. And we had 20 people donate. So we can move all of our equipment in, set up in the room, and move everything out at the end of the day also. We give you everything that you need to make it as easy as possible for you. So we'll give you signs, yard signs, posters, email templates, anything you need to get the word out. And if you have a special story of someone in your organization or in your school that you'd like to share, we'll coordinate with the family to develop a flyer and the verbiage and all of that for you. Everything will be ready to go. All we need your help with is getting the word out and getting them to sign up to donate blood. Okay, sign-ups are very, very important to us because we want to make sure that We send enough staff. We don't plan for 20 donors and have 75 people sign up, then we would have long wait times. They'd be frustrated. We also don't want to tell our hospitals we're going to have 70 people and only 20 people show up. So sign-ups are very, very important to us. That's the only thing we need your help with. And then this is my contact information and my partner, Carol. I'll give a card to everyone. If you're able to help set up a blood drive or put us in contact with someone who can set up a blood drive, we would really love to have your help. Okay. What questions do you guys have?
I have a question. I guess it's more for Melinda, but I guess any school can host. It's just up to the principal to get permission.
Mm-hmm. And we've done all kinds of things at different schools. Some of them have had blood drives on teacher work days when it's easier for staff to get away and donate. Sometimes they have a floating sub that helps cover classes so teachers can get away for a few minutes to donate, or they donate during their off periods. Sometimes there are events in the evening at the school, and we can have a blood drive then. We encourage you to invite PTO, PTA to participate and get parents to come in and donate as well. But anything that you need, we'll be happy to help with. Yes?
Can you tell us about the blood type? Like, what is
most needed? What blood types are most needed? We need all blood types, of course. The number one most needed blood type is O negative, and that's because they are the universal red cell donor. So their blood can go to absolutely anyone. So we're actually carrying O negative on life flights, on ambulances now in the community, and of course in the ER rooms, so that when they don't have time to test someone's blood, they can just get it to them immediately. And O negative can't get blood from anyone else but another O negative. So they're the universal donor, but they can't get it from anyone else. And they're only about 7% of the population. So 7% of donors supplying blood for all of those emergencies when we don't have time to test it. So every single day we start off with back-ordered requests from hospitals for more O negative. And we fill them as quickly as we can. If you're O negative, you probably hear from us a lot. and we might ask you to do red cell donations if you're O negative, because that way the blood is ready for patients more quickly. When you donate whole blood, we bring it back to our facility, and we actually split the red cells, plasma, and platelets, and it goes to three different people. So that's why you might have heard every blood donation saves three lives, because it's going to three different people.
When you give blood, do they tell you what blood type you are if you don't previously know?
Yes.
Okay.
So they will test everyone's blood type. They can test it on site and give you a preliminary answer, but we like to send it back to the lab, and within 24 hours, you'll be able to log into the app and see what your blood type is. That's where all of your points are. You can also keep track of what your blood pressure, temperature, pulse was each time you donated blood, your iron levels. All of that is in the app.
Okay.
Thank you. Yes?
As far as the rare blood donors, when you host one, would you all be able to say, send out emails to the rare blood donors in the areas where you're going to host to go ahead and try to encourage them to come in?
We don't do it on a drive-by-drive basis, but rather we contact donors on a regular basis and let them know what drives are coming in their area. So it's not, we wouldn't be doing something special for your drive, but we are doing that on a bigger scale for all of our blood drives.
So they would know what school that they're going to be at.
Right. And of course we have it on our website all of the time. They can always search by zip code for the nearest blood drive. It can also be closed to the public, so if there's some reason that you can't have visitors coming into your campus, we can have a blood drive that's not on our website. But the majority of our blood drives are open to the public, and they're posted, and they're easy to find. And then we also communicate with donors through phone calls, emails, and texts.
Do you have buttons or something? Because I know we all go to a lot of meetings where we can kind of have that.
That's a good idea. I don't think we do. We probably have some stickers I could get to you. But I don't think we have a button. But that's a good idea. Yeah,
I know it's my schedule. And then until you all send me that thing that says your rare blood donor get in, I'm like, okay.
Okay, yeah, that's a great idea. We can definitely do that. We do try to send emails out, especially to, we have, you know, we need 1,000 blood donors every day. We have a lot of blood drives every day, so we don't want to bombard you every single day with all the opportunities. But we do try to keep you informed at least every couple of weeks through different whatever works for you. You can sign up for text messages if that's easier, to just get a quick text reminder. You can sign up for emails or phone calls or whatever works. Yeah,
I was just going to say I got a text while you were speaking.
Right. The other cool thing is after you donate, you'll get a text letting you know when your blood is off to the hospital. And that's always a great feeling to check your message that morning and find out, hey, I'm saving someone's life today. Yes.
Okay, so I'm in the 97%. I've never done it. How long does it take, and how often can you donate?
Okay. Blood donation, for your first time, I would plan about an hour. It takes about 15 minutes to do the screening process. So we're going to check your temperature, pulse, your iron level, blood pressure, all of that. Make sure you're a good, healthy donor. Then there's a questionnaire you have to answer each time you donate blood about any international travel, high-risk activities, medications you might be taking, health history, all kinds of stuff. Once you get through all of that, that takes about 15 minutes. Then you move on to the donation bed. And if you do a whole blood donation, it takes about 15 minutes on the bed. Then we want you to rest and relax for a few minutes. So don't jump up off the bed the first time you donate blood and run out the door. We want you to make sure that you're not going to feel lightheaded, that you're back to 100% before you get off the bed. And then we have juice and cookies and refreshments for everyone. So when I go in, and I've donated over 100 times. I know I'm not going to have a reaction. I know to eat really well, drink lots of water, and sit down for a few minutes afterwards. I'm usually in and out in about 30 minutes, but plan for about an hour.
And why do you do the different types of donations if you can split it out? Like, why do they just do donations?
Okay, well, not everyone qualifies to do a red cell donation or a plasma donation. You have to have a little bit higher iron level. You have to have a little bit higher height and weight. Males usually tend to qualify more often than females because they tend to have higher iron levels, higher blood volumes. And so not everyone qualifies to do that. And not everyone wants to do another, you know, a red cell or plasma donation. You are on the bed a little bit longer. It pulls out just the red cells or just the plasma, and then it returns the rest of the components back to you with a saline solution. So there are time constraints also. But the reason we do it is because we can take a more concentrated unit of red cells or plasma from one donor. So if someone is needing a lot of blood transfusions or very regular blood transfusions, they can get a more concentrated unit of red cells from one person rather than multiple different people. So even though we're testing units for anything that could be passed on, it's always safer if you're receiving blood only from one person rather than from three people. And it's also ready to go, so we don't have to bring it back to our facility that night and have a team split it up and package it. It's ready to go to the patient as soon as it clears testing. So it's beneficial for the patient. It's beneficial for the donor because they get a saline solution back, which rehydrates them, so they're not giving 2 units of blood. We're not taking 2 pints from them. We're just taking a little bit higher concentration. So it's better for everyone if they're able to qualify for that. How often you can donate depends on what you donate. Regular whole blood donations, it's every 8 weeks. Plasma donations, you can do once a month. Platelet donations, you can do up to 24 times a year. So you can sometimes even do that twice within 1 week, as long as you don't do more than 24 in a year. And we have people that do that 24 times a year. They're regularly in our donor centers. I have a great volunteer who is about to turn 80 years old on December 31st. She's donated over 180 gallons of blood. So, and that's by doing platelets 24 times a year, as often as she's eligible, all the time. And she hasn't stopped. She not only volunteers with us all the time. She hosts blood drives at our church, and she's in the donor centers in between. She's pretty much with us 40 hours a week volunteering. Yes.
Okay, not to steal from getting any pool to set up, but the Cypher Fire Department is hosting a blood drive on Thursday at their admin office. So if anybody wants to strike while the iron's hot, there's a place for you to go and donate Thursday.
Yes, and we're still trying to get donations, so yes, definitely sign up for that one too.
But still sign your school up. So.
Right. You can come and donate, help bring us in another donation at that drive. But if you host a drive at your school and you get 15 more people to come out, that's even better. Okay. What other questions? No? Okay. I think that's it. Yes.
Do the hospitals have to pay for the blood that's provided?
We are nonprofit, and we are partnered with all of the hospitals. So there are costs associated with, you know, our staff and our vehicles and gas and all of that. They're not charges for the blood itself, but they do help reimburse those costs of collecting blood. So just like if they have their own blood drives, they have expenses, they help reimburse that. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'll hand out my cards also. So.
Thank you, Katie. Just great information, and yes, as was said, just do what you can. If you personally can give, and the nice thing is we know so many different people that we could recruit to do that. I didn't realize I've been giving for, gosh, like I said at the beginning, long, long, long time, but I learned some things I didn't know as well. So that's just very informational, educational. We appreciate that. Melinda, I think that kind of brings close of our meeting. Is that correct? Anything else?
No. And if you were staying for the subcommittee for physical education, she, Elaine, is not with us today, so we're going to postpone that meeting until next time.
Okay.
So
you heard from Chef what we have over there, so please, we didn't give you that cue time for that second topic, but the hope is that once you get your food and sit down at the table, you can just continue to talk about everything, you know, what you learned today, and then, you know, what's happening for your holidays or whatever else you want to talk about. So please make yourself at home. You got drinks over there, tea and water, and then lots of food. It's okay, you start with the cookies as well. Probably what I'll do. Thank you, thank you.